My name is BC Holmes. I work with a group in Toronto called the Toronto Haiti Action Committee, and we're part of a larger Canada-wide group called the Canada Haiti Action Network. And basically, we're not an aid or relief organization. What we are is a social justice advocacy organization, and we've been trying to raise awareness about Haiti and specifically some of the areas where Canadian policy toward Haiti is having an effect on that country there. The group came together in 2004 after the coup that ousted the president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and we've been trying to talk ever since about how Canada played a role in that ousting and how Canada continues to play a role shaping policy in Haiti, not for the best. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about some history of Haiti and current issues. So one of the things I will say is I've been to Haiti 8 times since 2002, and in fact, I was there just after Christmas. I went down for a human rights social justice delegation, meeting with victims of violence, human rights leaders, community leaders, et cetera, to find out things. I returned on January 7th, which was 5 days before the earthquake hit. And as you can imagine, when the earthquake hit, that felt very, very near. So I will also try to talk about some of the things that I saw there. So let's do a couple of quick facts about Haiti to start off with. Haiti is located on the island of Hispaniola, which is the western third of the island in the Caribbean. It's very close to Cuba and very close to Florida. The languages that they speak there, the two official languages, are French and Creole. Creole is actually a recent addition to their list of official languages, which is strange because that's the language that 95% of the population there speaks. And that, I think, is indicative of an ongoing problem in Haiti, which is that the control of the government has often been in the hands of a relatively small minority whose interests are very different from the majority of the people there. Their population is about 10 million, about 3 million of which live in the capital of Port-au-Prince. So if you've been watching the news, Port-au-Prince is where most of the damage from the earthquake has hit, Port-au-Prince and some of the southern areas. One-third of the population, almost one-third of the population, lives in Port-au-Prince. So you can imagine this event has hit people the worst. Their GDP is about $11 billion. That's a boring thing. But this other funny number that's up there on the screen is called the Gini coefficient. And what that relates to is the degree of unequalness of wealth distribution in a particular country. So a Gini coefficient of 59.2 is actually one of the highest, I think it is the highest, that you'll see in the Western Hemisphere. And what that reflects is the fact that the vast majority of the wealth in the country is in the hands of a very small number of people. In fact, in Haiti, there are 10 major families that basically control the majority of the wealth in Haiti. There are three of them in particular whose initials are B, A, and M. They're often called BAM or BAM BAM, which is a Creole word that means give me. So it's an interesting moniker. When I was in Haiti just recently, I spent most of my time in the capital of Port-au-Prince, which you can see in that bay area there, and then went down south to Jacmel. And if you've watched any of the coverage about where the earthquake has hit, you'll see maps like this and discover very quickly that that is exactly where the earthquake has subsequently gone on to wreak havoc. What I wanted to do is talk about a very fast history of Haiti, because I think understanding how Haiti got to the place that it is now is crucial to understanding some of the things that are going on. And I'm indebted to this man, Georges Wooley, who basically gave me this particular overview, which I'm repeating to you today. So you can imagine the history of Haiti as basically having four main eras or four main periods. There's the pre-colonial period, about which we can actually say the least, unfortunately. It was the period in which the island of Hispaniola was home to an indigenous people who lived there before Columbus arrived. But the moment Columbus arrived, Haiti became an important colony in which European colonialism mattered a great deal. And that period goes right up until 1804, at which point there's a war of independence, and then begins a nationalist period. And then that's followed by a neocolonial period. I want to talk about each of these in order. So the pre-colonial period, it's very easy to slip into the language to say, you know, in 1492, Columbus discovered the island of Hispaniola. That suggests that, you know, none of the people who lived there beforehand bothered to discover the country, which is a problematic way of phrasing things. In truth, the island of Hispaniola was home to an indigenous people called the Tainu people. They're part of the Arawak people. And following the arrival of the Europeans, the Tainu were basically obliterated very, very quickly. And according to Wikipedia, they say this is possibly the worst case of depopulation in the Americas. And I'm sure everyone here realizes that the Americas have never been very kind to an indigenous people. Our history with the indigenous people in Canada has certainly not been a great history. So think about those histories and imagine in Haiti it was quite a bit worse. Within, you know, decades, 99.9% of the Tainu people were gone. The popular theory is that it was exposure to European diseases that led to this depopulation, or also the possibility of having tried to enslave them and force them to become laborers for the Europeans also played a role. Once Columbus discovered the island of Hispaniola, and he discovered it because he actually ran one of his ships aground just north of the island of Hispaniola near a city that's now called Cap Haïtien, that island suddenly became an extremely important island during the entire colonial period. By the time of the 1620s, permanent settlements had started to crop up in Hispaniola, and a sort of battle for control of the island emerged between Spain and France. And France, in 1697, was granted by the Spanish government, or ceded, the western third of the island of France. And they created the colony that they called Saint-Domingue, but what ultimately that became was Haiti. That western third, essentially pretty much still the same borders of the Haitian country. During the colonial period, I think a lot of people today don't realize how significant Haiti was in that colonial period. During the colonial period, by the 1780s, it was producing 40% of all of the sugar that was consumed in Europe. It was producing 60% of all the coffee that was consumed in Europe. It was contributing a huge amount to the wealth of France, but it was doing so on the back of slavery. The reason that they were able to produce so much wealth so cheaply was because they had slaves in Haiti like you wouldn't believe. Their laborers provided about 800,000 slaves in the early to mid-1780s. 10 to 15,000 slaves a year were being taken to Haiti, 40,000 a year from about 1787 onward. And the slave trade to Haiti itself accounted for about a third of the entire Atlantic slave trade. These are incredible numbers. The one thing that France was vulnerable to in terms of Haiti was the idea that the slaves would suddenly realize, you know, we don't want to take this anymore and rise up against their masters, which is exactly what happened starting in 1791. In 1791, a rebellion broke out, which ultimately became the Haitian Revolution. The slaves said, we're not going to be slaves anymore. We are going to rise up against the French, kick the French out, and take this country back for ourselves because we don't believe that we should have to live in slavery anymore. The Haitian Revolution, it's impossible to underestimate or underscore the importance of the Haitian Revolution, especially to the Haitian people. Every Haitian I've met has talked to me at great length and glowingly about the significance of the Haitian Revolution to the Haitian character. I mostly don't want to give him any attention, but Pat Robertson made this embarrassing comment about Haiti having made a pact with the devil. And what he was referring to was, in fact, one of the most significant events that led to the beginning of the Haitian Revolution, where people met in Bois Caïman. The slaves came from many different nations and had many different spiritual practices, although they shared some things in common. That they performed a spiritual ceremony at Bois Caïman that many people point to these days and say that is where the Haitian Revolution began. And so that's why Pat Robertson points to this and says, what they were doing doesn't look very Christian to us and therefore must be a pact with the devil. So the Haitian Revolution is a huge event, especially for the Haitian character. And even to this day, I think that one of the things that Canadians and Americans underestimate is the extent to which Haitians will resist having to live under an outside force or having to live under an outside oppressor. I've met so many people who speak eloquently and beautifully about how even if Haiti has to live in abject poverty, they would rather do that than have to live under the heel of an outside oppressor. It took about 13 years, but ultimately the Haitians won the Haitian Revolution. In the course of fighting for their freedom, they had to fight off the three most powerful armies in the world. So they fought the French army, they fought the Spanish army, they fought the English army, all to gain their freedom. From 1804, January 1st, 1804 is considered to be the Independence Day in Haiti, and that is when their nationalist phase really begins. They accomplished a great deal in this nationalist phase. In many ways, this was the first truly universal fight for freedom in the Americas. When the slaves took over Haiti, they introduced 100% emancipation without exception. All the slaves were freed. Everyone was made a citizen of the country. Everyone had some amount of legal equality, which wasn't true in other places like the United States, for example. I often argue with my American friends who say, the U.S. is the oldest republic, and I say, do you consider it a republic when so many of the people were enslaved back at the beginning? They also introduced a couple of really important historical points. In 1815, Simon Bolivar took refuge in Haiti. He was trying to get a revolution going in South America. At one point, you know, he needed to take refuge in Haiti. And while he was there, the Haitian people recognized what he was trying to do and said, we will support you. We will give you weapons. We will give you soldiers. We will give you equipment. And possibly one of the most important things for a revolutionary at the time, we will give you a printing press. And we'll give you all of these things if you take them to your fight in South America on the condition, one condition, that when you win your revolution, you will abolish slavery. This was a significant point in the Bolivarian movement, and countries like Venezuela still remember the role that Haiti played in their history. A more unfortunate situation happened in 1820 when the Boyer government was in power in Haiti. This was, you know, 16 years after the revolution. Much of the army had stood down at that point. They had returned to a sense of normalcy in the country. And all of a sudden, France sailed a bunch of warships into the harbor and suddenly demanded that they be repaid for compensation for lost property. And by lost property, they include slaves and all of the wealth that they were able to, that they felt that they should have been able to get off of the backs of slaves. They demanded 150 million French francs. This was a crushing amount of debt to impose upon the Haitian people. They demanded this basically at the barrel of a gun. They had warships in the bay at the time. And so when many people now today ask, what's wrong with Haiti? Why is Haiti so poor? It's not that Haiti's poor. Their money's been stolen. France came in and took their money. Well, Haiti couldn't afford to pay it all back in one lump sum. So what they had to do is they had to borrow money to pay the French. And then they had to pay back that loan with interest over the next century and a bit. I was just reading this fascinating speech given by Frederick Douglass, the orator and statesman, who was talking about his relationship to Haiti, in which he talks about, you know, Haiti has a lot of wealth and, you know, we wish they were better friends to the U.S., but they're not, and maybe that's our own fault because, you know, we refuse to recognize them as an independent country for so long. Many of the same things still went on there. It was still an agricultural center, still was able to produce large amounts of sugar and coffee for the rest of the world. I mentioned Frederick Douglass, who in the 1890s talked about, you know, the amount of wealth that Haiti still had. But by about 1915, the U.S. was starting to look at Haiti and say, we think that we should have access to more of that wealth. And they invaded the country, beginning what Georges talks about as the neocolonial period. And the central agenda of this neocolonial period is characterized by the U.S. desire to control the wealth of Haiti. So what they're saying is, we think we should have the ability to buy the businesses or somehow tap into the wealth of Haiti so that we can profit off of that. This is in many ways the same agenda that colonialism had, but they're doing it without actually having a colony there, although they did have an occupation for the first part of this period. They're not an official colony, but the U.S. and other countries like that want to be able to say, we want enough control over the country and its businesses and its economy that we can profit off of it. And it's essentially the same agendas as colonialism. The U.S. eventually stopped occupying the country of Haiti, but they left a lot of systems in place so that they can still have a certain amount of control over the country. In particular, they drastically reformed the Haitian army, which, you know, was in many ways still closely allied with the U.S. and the U.S. Interests. But it wasn't until Duvalier came along that they really felt that they had the best particular government going on in Haiti. The relationship between Duvalier and the U.S. was rocky at first. Kennedy and Duvalier famously didn't actually see eye to eye. But Duvalier, in becoming the president of Haiti and ultimately later electing himself to be president for life or declaring himself to be president for life in Haiti, was able to produce the perfect environment for Haitian business interests. He was able to use fear and intimidation and violence against the people to keep people complacent and fall in line with his particular goals. And he was able to keep people poor, making them available for cheap labor to the U.S. There was a time when the U.S. used to brag about the fact that every baseball in the country was manufactured in Haiti. Baseballs are very labor-intensive things to make. They're pretty much always made by hand, etc. Under the Duvalier era, what you had was this very well-controlled country, very poor, and able to produce a lot of things cheaply for the United States consumption. It was also a time of tourism. Lots of tourists used to go to Haiti, including sex tourism. And the U.S. loved that. The U.S. thought that Duvalier was a great thing, and they lavished all kinds of aid on him. He was definitely an elite. He was a different kind of elite than the historic elite. So for many, many years in Haiti, there was a mixed race class. The Haitians use the word mulatto, even though this word isn't used a whole lot in Canada anymore. There was a mixed race class of families that tended to control a lot of the wealth and tended to form a lot of the leaders. One of the things that Duvalier was very different in about was the fact that he did not come from this particular class. And he actually, he came to power by championing the causes of the black majority. And so initially he seemed to be a great thing for Haiti in that he was saying, you know, the black majority deserves to be represented in our government. But unfortunately he later became a very, very brutal dictator in that country. And when he died, he made sure that power transferred to his son, Jean-Claude Duvalier. So prior to the earthquake, there was a court case that was going on about some money that Duvalier had. The U.S. during the Duvalier period gave a great deal of aid to Haiti, but the Haitian people didn't see most of it. Most of it went into the private bank accounts of the Duvaliers themselves. Switzerland was involved in this huge court case in which people from Haiti had challenged whether or not this one particular bank account that contained a lot of his money should actually be given back to the Haitian people because it was, you know, aid that had originally been given to Haiti. Prior to the earthquake, a few months ago, Switzerland had made the decision that they were not going to give it to Duvalier, but they were instead going to allegedly give it back to Haiti, but they didn't trust the Haitian government with it, which I think is exactly. I think that's deeply problematic. They decided that they were going to choose some of their favorite aid agencies that were operating in Haiti, and they were going to give the money there. That went through a court challenge, and their courts basically ruled that, you know, no, it must be given back to Duvalier. But since the earthquake has happened, that's a deeply embarrassing position for the Swiss government to be in. And so they basically said, we're going to ignore that ruling and keep doing what we wanted to. So it's not really going back to the Haitian people. It's going back to Western aid agencies that operate in Haiti. So toward the end of the second Duvalier, Baby Doc, they call him, the father is called Papa Doc, and the son is called Baby Doc. Toward the end of Baby Doc's time in office, there was a huge growing democracy movement in Haiti. And I think this is the crucial part to understand the last two decades of history in Haiti. This democracy movement was growing in response to the fact that they had lived under a brutal dictatorship for decades, and in many ways found its home in what are called the Ti L'Église, or the little churches in Haiti. For historical reasons, Duvalier got into a special arrangement with the Vatican so that he was allowed to appoint the bishops in the country. So he picked brutal military dictators, brutal military guys to become bishops. But one of the good sides of that particular ugly relationship was that the people, the priests in the country, didn't feel like they had to really answer to the bishops in the country. And so they were suddenly becoming the community leaders, the activists, the political agitators, and they were espousing a lot of ideas about advancing the causes of the poor majority. There was a movement that was happening in the Catholic Church at the time called Liberation Theology, which is basically finds its home in the parts of the more radical parts of the Bible that say things like, you know, society has special obligation to the poor majority, and that society must, you know, society must turn its attention to the poor majority. And one of the most vocal proponents of this movement was a priest by the name of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And what he founded was what's called the Lavalas movement. Aristide tried to describe Lavalas in this way. He said, Lavalas is a Creole word. It means the flood or the cleansing flood. And he said, you know, individual people are like drops of water. And by themselves, and a single drop of water can only accomplish so much. But you get enough drops of water together, and what you get is a flood that will come through. It will cleanse the land of corruption, of oppression, etc. And so he created this movement called the Lavalas Movement. And that Lavalas Movement is unfortunately something that Western powers like the U.S. and Canada really doesn't like. So after Jean-Claude Duvalier fled the country in 86, I think it was, the country started to move toward an open form of democracy because that's what the people seemed to be espousing. But the U.S. was really positioning their people to make sure that they controlled the sort of form of democracy that would take place there. So one of their candidates, Marc Bazin, was their favorite person. You know, they put him out there as a candidate for the upcoming elections that ultimately took place in 1990. But Aristide entered that presidential race fairly late and won by a huge landslide. So Aristide won 67% of the vote in that particular election. Bazin, the next runner-up, was 14% of the vote. Aristide was immensely popular then and remains immensely popular today. If Aristide were in the country today and running in an election, he would win by a landslide. This is just a fact about Haiti. Unfortunately, the U.S. didn't like that. And what has emerged in Haiti for the last 20 years has been this one primary conflict over whether or not the role of the Haitian government is to concern itself with the issues of the poor, or the role of the Haitian government is to concern itself with being business friendly. And you have to understand that the poor constitute a massive majority in Haiti. If you use the World Bank's definition of poor, people who make less than $2 a day are considered to be poor by the World Bank's definition. I'm not a big fan of citing the World Bank, but I think that their definition is reasonable in this case. That's 80% of the population in Haiti. That majority actually really believes that the role of the government is to concern itself with education and promotion of the interests of the poor in Haiti, rather than trying to make things business friendly so that a bunch of business people can make lots of money. In many ways, the U.S. views democracy in Haiti as a threat to business interests in Haiti. And although Aristide's goal for the country was a very modest goal, what he wanted to do was to move the country from what he said, absolute misery, to poverty with dignity. He said it would be great if people could make, you know, enough money to have a meal a day, etc. That modest goal was very threatening to the people who control the money in Haiti, again, those 10 powerful families, and to external powers like the U.S., Canada, and France. Throughout the last two decades, there have been two coups in the country. The first one happened in 1991. Aristide was 9 months into his mandate. He was clearly trying to establish an agenda that would include things like education programs, you know, trying to improve the lot for the poor majority there. And then all of a sudden, a coup happened. There was actually one small coup attempt even before he took the office of president, but this is the first significant coup. During the coup period, this first coup period was an exceptionally brutal period for Haiti. Haiti's political pro-democracy movement was deeply targeted by the military that was there that had close ties to the U.S. U.S. military and to the U.S. Secret Service organizations. Many community leaders and many pro-democracy leaders were murdered or otherwise targeted or hurt. Ultimately, at the point that, you know, the Western media just couldn't stop paying attention, had to start paying attention to what was going on in Haiti, there came to be this growing movement that was calling for the U.S. to do something to return Aristide to Haiti. The U.S. was not actually terribly interested in returning Aristide to Haiti, but eventually could no longer ignore the fact that the coup leaders were absolutely brutal in Haiti. And so they allowed Aristide to return, but they forced many terrible restrictions on him. So, for example, they said that all of the time that he was in exile out of the country must count against his time in office. So although he had a five-year term, almost 3.5 years of those were spent out of the country. Those had to count against his term of office. He was initially in Venezuela, and then he went to the U.S. for much of that time. You know, he had to start adopting a large number of the policies that his opponent, Marc Bazin, would have championed: privatization of the government industries, you know, reducing of trade tariffs that existed, etc. These are all pro-business friendly policies that he was forced to adopt as a condition of his return to the country. And then when his term ended in 1995, He became the first Haitian leader in the history of the country to willingly transfer power to a successor. Haiti has had a large number of coups, a large number of military upsets, etc. He became the first Haitian leader to say, you know, my term is done, I willingly stand down, and my successor, who is a guy by the name of René Préval, who's the president today, will become my successor because he was elected. In 2000, Aristide was elected again. As I mentioned earlier, Aristide is immensely popular. He was not allowed to run in 95 because the Haitian constitution says that the same person can't be president two terms in a row. But when he, when 2000 came along and the next presidential election came about, he was one of the candidates. He won the election in 2000 and became president in 2001. And he won by a landslide, and everyone knew he was going to win by a landslide. And so rather than try to do anything to challenge his presidency, what the international community did instead was focus its energy on trying to be able to claim that this election was not legitimate. So they were saying that it was fraudulent. They were saying that almost no people came out. They said that there is a lot of claims of miscounting of the votes. And they were actually took a great deal of effort to be opaque about the fact that many of the things they were pointing out didn't have anything to do with the presidential election. There was a senatorial and rest of government election that happened in the same year, and so they pointed to some elections that were happening earlier than presidential election and said, you know, there was something funny going on there. So clearly the presidential election was marred by electoral fraud and flaws, when none of those things seemed to be supported by the people who are on the ground there. I myself have actually spoken to several people who were election observers in that particular election, and universally they say, these charges that the U.S. have made about that election are just wrong. They're false. You know, they aren't consistent with what I saw there. But nonetheless, what the U.S. did was try to create this media frenzy in which Aristide was trashed in the media and Aristide was painted as this person who was corrupt, he was fraudulently elected, he was engaged in human rights abuses, etc. Until finally in 2004, a group of rebel soldiers who were supplied by the U.S. and trained arguably by the U.S. and given guns and vehicles and other supplies by the U.S. entered into the country and started creating this sort of media spectacle where they would go in to a town in the north, they would take over the town, which meant for them go to the police station and kill the three police officers that work in that town. And our media started reporting this as this gang of rebels who looked poised to take over the country. In fact, they were a group of like 100 soldiers who had no chance whatsoever of taking over the country. But our media presented this as the people in Haiti rising up against the Aristide government, when in fact it was a very small group of people with close ties to the U.S. who were creating this sort of media spectacle that was a distraction, and in many ways prepared here. So that by February 29th, 2004, Aristide was forced to flee the country, partially because he was concerned that if these rebels did come to Port-au-Prince, he didn't really believe that they would have the ability to overthrow the government, but he did believe that they had the ability to cause a lot of death and destruction. And so he ultimately, under duress, elected to leave the country, although he certainly wasn't in charge of the terms of his leaving of the country. Thank you.